Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's Matt Jensen, The Last Mountain Man. Narrated by Dylan Lynch. With performances by Thomas Penny, Lily Beacon, James Konacek, Danny Gavigan, Terrence Aselford, Bradley Smith, Thomas Keegan, Alexander Strain, David Coyne, Gregory Gorton, Richard Rowan, Joe Brack, Anastasia Wilson, Michael John Casey, Alyssa Wilmoth, Tony Nam, Nick DePinto, Christopher Sheeran, Michael Glenn, Tim Carlin, Casey Platt, and Jeff Baker. Matt Jensen number 5, Snake River Slaughter.
Sweetwater County, Wyoming. The Baker brothers, Harry and Arnold, stood outside the barn watching as Jules Pratt and his wife came out of the McDonald house. Scott and Lucy McDonald walked out on the porch as Jules climbed into the Surrey.
Thank you, Mr. McDonald. You have been most generous. Speaking on behalf of the laity of the church, I can tell you that every time we hear the beautiful music of the new organ, we will be thinking of and thanking you.
Scott McDonald smiled.
It was our pleasure. The church means a great deal to us, more than we can say. And we're more than happy to do anything we can to help out.
We'll see you Sunday.
Jules slapped the reins against the back of the team. Lucy McDonald went back into the house, but before Scott went back inside, he looked over toward the barn at the two brothers.
How are you two boys coming on the wagon?
We're working on it.
I'm going to be needing it pretty soon now, so you let me know if you run into any trouble with it.
McDonald went back inside. Harry and Arnold Baker were not permanent employees of the McDonald's. They had been hired the day before for the specific purpose of making repairs to the freight wagon. Harry turned back to his brother.
Did you see that money box?
You mean when he gave that other fella a donation for the organ?
Yeah, I seen it.
There has to be $200, maybe $300 in that box.
How long would it take us to make that kind of money?
Hell, it would take the better part of a year for us to make that much money, even if we was to put our earnings together.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Harry, you want to know what I'm thinking?
If you're thinking the same thing I'm thinking, I know what it is.
Let's go in there and get that money.
He ain't gonna give it up and just give it to us.
He will if we threaten to kill him.
Harry shook his head.
Just threatening him ain't gonna be enough. We're gonna have to do it. Otherwise, he'll set the sheriff on us. And what about the others? His wife and kids? You want the two boys to grow up and come after us?
Nah, I guess not.
If we are gonna do this thing, Arnold, there's only one way to do it.
All right, let's do it.
Pulling their guns and checking their loads, the two brothers put their pistols back in their holsters and crossed the distance between the barn and the house. Without so much as a warning knock, they pushed the door open and strode inside. Lucy spun around at the intrusion. Arnold glanced around the kitchen.
Get your husband.
Lucy left the kitchen, then returned a moment later with Scott. Scott wasn't wearing his gun, which was going to make this even easier than they had planned.
Lucy said you two boys just walked into the house without so much as a fare thee well. You know better than to do that. What do you want?
The money.
The money? You mean you finished the wagon? Well, good, good. Let me take a look at it, and if I'm satisfied, I'll give you your $10.
Harry shook his head.
No, not $10. All of it.
I beg your pardon?
Harry drew his pistol, and when he did, Arnold drew his as well.
The money box. Get it down. We want all the money.
Oh, Scott.
It's all right, Lucy. I'm going to give them what they ask for. Then they'll go away and leave us alone. Get the box down and hand it to them.
You're a smart man, McDonald.
You'll never get away with this.
Lucy retrieved the box from the top of the cupboard, then handed it over to Harry. Harry took the money from the box. Folding the money over, he stuck it in his pocket.
Hell yeah, we're gonna get away with it.
You son of a bitch!
Arnold's bullet drove Scott back against the wall. He slid to the floor, leaving a crimson trail on the wall.
All right, Harry. Let's finish off the kids and get out of here.
Matt Jensen dismounted in front of the Gold Strike Saloon. Brushing some of the trail dust away, he tied his horse off at the hitching rail, then began looking at the other horses that were there, lifting the left hind foot of each animal in turn. His action seemed a little peculiar, and some of the pedestrians stopped to look over at him. They saw a man just a bit over 6 feet tall, with broad shoulders and a narrow waist. He was young in his years, but his pale blue eyes bespoke experiences that most would not see in 3 lifetimes. He was a lone wolf who once wore a deputy's badge in Abilene, rode shotgun for a stagecoach out of Lordsburg, scouted for the Army in the McDowell Mountains of Arizona, and panned for gold in Idaho. A banker's daughter in Cheyenne once thought she could make him settle down. A soiled dove in the territories knew that she couldn't, but took what he offered. Matt was a wanderer, always wondering what was beyond the next line of hills, just over the horizon. He traveled light with a bowie knife, a .44 double-action Colt, a Winchester .44-40 rifle, a rain slicker, an overcoat, 2 blankets, and a spare shirt, socks, trousers, and underwear. He called Colorado his home, though he started life in Kansas. Colorado was home only because it was where he reached maturity, and Smoke Jensen, the closest thing he had to a family, lived there. In truth, though, he spent no more time in Colorado than he did in Wyoming, Utah, New Mexico, or Arizona. At the moment, Matt was on the trail of Harry and Arnold Baker for the murder of Scott McDonald, his wife Lucy, and their 2 young sons, Toby and Tyler. Before he died, Scott McDonald managed to live long enough to scrawl the letters B-A-K on the floor, using his finger as a pen and his own blood as the ink. McDonald hired the Baker brothers not because he needed the help, but because he thought they were down on their luck and needed the job. Matt had known the McDonalds well. He had been a guest in their house many times and attended the baptism of one of their children. When the McDonalds were killed, Matt took it very personally. He got himself temporarily deputized so he could hunt down the Baker brothers and bring them to justice. One of the Baker brothers rode a horse that left a distinctive hoof print, and that enabled Matt to track them to Burnt Fork. That brought him to the front of the Gold Strike Saloon, where he was checking the shoes of the horses that were tied off at the hitching rail. He found what he was looking for. The shoe on this horse's left rear foot had a V-shaped niche on the inside of the right arm of the shoe. He loosened his pistol in its holder. Matt stepped inside, and sitting at a table in the middle of the saloon were 2 men. Each of the men had a girl sitting on his lap, and the table had a nearly empty whiskey bottle, indicating they had been drinking heavily. Matt had never seen the Baker brothers, so he could not identify them by sight, but the 2 men resembled each other enough to be brothers, and they did match the description he had been given of them.
Hey, Harry, let's see which one of these girls has the best.
Arnold grabbed the top of the dress of the girl who was sitting on his lap and jerked it down.
Ow! Stop that!
The girl jumped up from his lap and began pulling the top of her dress back up.
Arnold! You done got that girl all mad at you!
They'd called each other Harry and Arnold. That was all the verification Matt needed. Turning back toward the bar, he signaled the bartender.
Yes, sir. What can I do for you?
I need you to get the women away from those 2 men.
Mister, as long as those men are paying, the girls can stay.
I'm about to arrest those 2 men for murder. If they resist arrest, I intend to kill them. I wouldn't want the women to be in the way.
Oh, yeah, I see what you mean. But I don't know how to get them away without telling what's about to happen.
Go down to the other end of the bar, take out a new bottle of whiskey, tell the men it's on the house, you're giving it to them for being good customers. Then call the women over to get it.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Matt remained there with his back to the men while the bartender walked down to the other end of the bar. He put a bottle of whiskey up on the bar.
Jane, Ellie Mae, come up here for a moment.
Hey, bartender, you leave these girls with us. They're enjoying our company.
We're enjoying your company too, sir. You spent a lot of money with us and you've been such good customers and all. We're pleased to offer you a bottle of whiskey on the house. That is, if you'll let the girls come up to get it.
Well, hell, you two girls go on up there and get the bottle. And if you're good to us, why, we'll let you have a few drinks. Right, Arnold?
Right, Harry.
From his position in the saloon, Matt watched in the mirror as the two girls left the table and started toward the bartender. Not until he was sure they were absolutely clear did he turn around.
Hello, Harry. Hello, Arnold.
What? Do you know us?
No, but I know who you are. I was a good friend of the McDonald's.
We don't know anyone named McDonald.
Sure you do. You murdered them.
The two men leaped up then, starting toward the guns, but when they saw how quickly Matt had his own pistol out, they stopped, then raised their hands.
Don't shoot! Don't shoot!
We ain't drawn, mister! We ain't drawn!
Within a week of their capture, the two brothers stood trial in the Sweetwater County Courthouse. Although seats were dear to come by, Sheriff Foley held a place for Matt, so he was able to move through the crowd of people searching for their own place to sit.
Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay! This court of Sweetwater County, Green River City, Wyoming, will now come to order. The Honorable Judge Daniel Norton presiding. All rise.
As Judge Norton came into the courtroom and stepped up to the bench, Matt Jensen stood with the others.
Be seated. Bailiff, call the first case.
There is only one case, Your Honor. There comes now before this court Harry G. Baker and Arnold S. Baker, both men having been indicted for the crime of murder in the first degree.
Thank you, Bailiff. Are the defendants represented by counsel?
The defense attorney stood.
I am Robert Dempster, Your Honor, duly certified before the bar and appointed by the court to defend the Misters Baker.
Is prosecution present?
The prosecutor stood.
I am Edmund Gleason, Your Honor, duly certified before the bar and appointed by the court to prosecute.
Let the record show that the people are represented by a duly certified prosecutor and the defendants are represented by a duly certified counsel.
Dempster rose quickly.
Your Honor, if it please the court.
Yes, Mr. Dempster, what is it?
Your Honor, I object to the fact that we are trying both defendants at the same time, and I request separate trials.
Mr. Dempster, both men are being accused of the same crime, which was committed at the same time. It seems only practical to try them both at the same time. Request denied.
Dempster sat down without further protest.
Mr. Prosecutor, are you ready to proceed?
I am ready, Your Honor.
Very good. Then please make your case.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Gleason stood to make his opening remarks. Over the rest of the morning, the prosecution produced witnesses and material evidence to support the charges. The defense presented one witness, Jerome Kelly, who claimed to have run an errand with the McDonald's at the same time Jules Pratt and other church members accepted the McDonald's contribution to the organ fund. After lunch, the lawyers presented their closing arguments. Less than 1 hour after the closing arguments, the jury returned from their deliberation.
Gentlemen of the jury, have you reached a verdict?
A tall, gray-haired man stood.
We have, Your Honor.
Would you state the verdict, please?
We find the defendants, Harry and Arnold Baker, guilty of murder in the first degree.
I will not have any demonstrations in my court.
The judge looked around the courtroom.
Bailiff. Where's the witness, Jerome Kelly?
He's not present, Your Honor.
Sheriff Foley, I'm putting out a bench warrant on defense witness Jerome Kelly for giving false testimony. Please find him and take him into custody. Now, bailiff, if you would, bring the convicted before the bench.
The two men were brought to stand before the judge.
Harry Baker and Arnold Baker, I have presided over thousands of cases in my 26 years on the bench. But never in my career have I encountered anyone with less redemptive tissue than the two of you. Your crime in murdering an entire family, a family that had taken you into their bosom, is particularly heinous. You have been tried and found guilty by a jury of your peers. Therefore, It is my sentence that 1 week hence, the sheriff of Sweetwater County will lead the two of you to the gallows at 10 o'clock in the morning. Once upon the gallows, ropes will be placed around your necks, all support will be withdrawn from under your feet, and you shall be dropped a distance sufficient to break your necks. And there, Harry Baker and Arnold Baker, you shall continue to hang until it is obvious that all life has left your miserable bodies. May God have mercy on your souls, for I have none.
The gallows stood in the middle of Center Street, well constructed but terrible in the gruesomeness of its function. A professionally painted sign stood on an easel in front of the gallows. On this gallows at 10 o'clock on Thursday morning will be hung the murderers Harry and Arnold Baker. All are invited. Attendance is free. The idea of a double hanging had drawn visitors for miles around, not only because of the morbid curiosity such a spectacle generated, but also because the McDonald family had been very well liked, and the murders the two condemned had committed, including the murder of Scott McDonald's wife and children, were particularly shocking. The street overflowed with spectators, and the crowd continued to grow as they all jostled for position. Matt glanced over toward the tower clock in front of the courthouse to check the time. It was 5 minutes after 10. The judge had said they would be hanged at 10 o'clock, which meant that the prisoners should have been brought out by now. Some in the crowd were growing impatient.
What in the Sam Hill's going on?
Matt began to have the strange feeling something was wrong. He slipped away from the crowd and walked around into the alley behind the jail. He was going to look in through the back window, but he didn't have to. The moment he stepped into the alley, he saw the Baker brothers and the man who had given false testimony on their behalf, Jerome Kelly, coming through the back door.
Hold it!
Oh, it's Jensen!
The bullet hit the wall beside Matt, sending little brick chips into his face. Matt returned fire, and Harry went down. By now, both Arnold Baker and Kelly were shooting as well. Matt dove to the ground, then rolled over and shot again. Arnold clutched his chest and went down.
Don't shoot!
Kelly, now seeing that both Bakers were down, dropped his gun and threw up his hands. At that moment, Sheriff Foley came out of the jail, holding his pistol in one hand while holding his other hand to a bleeding wound on his head.
Jensen, are you all right?
Yeah, I'm not hit. How about you?
They killed my deputy, and I've got a knot in my head where this son of a bitch hit me.
The sheriff looked at Harry and Arnold Baker.
I wonder if you saved the county the cost of the execution, or if we'll have to pay the hangman anyway. Or maybe we can just go ahead and have the hanging, only it'll be Kelly instead of the Baker brothers.
Sawtooth Mountains, Idaho Territory. Colonel Clay Sherman was a tall man with broad shoulders and narrow hips. He had steel gray eyes and he wore a neatly trimmed mustache, which now, like his hair, was dusted with gray. He was the commanding officer of the Idaho Auxiliary Peace Officers Posse. The posse consisted of 2 officers and 32 men, all duly sworn as functioning, though unpaid, deputies to the Idaho Territorial Task Force. Clay Sherman received his commission from the Assistant Deputy Attorney General of the Territory of Idaho, and as such, was duly authorized to deputize those who joined the posse. Sherman and his auxiliary peace officers wore deputies' badges, but because they were not paid by the territorial government, the posse supported itself, and supported itself very well, by acting as a private police force. Most of the posse's income was generated when it was hired by the disgruntled to get justice where they felt justice had been denied. So far, the posse had managed to avoid any trouble with territorial federal law agencies because they managed to find loopholes to allow them to operate. But their operations always walked a very narrow line between legality and illegality, and had either the territorial or federal government taken the trouble to conduct a thorough investigation, it would have discovered that, in fact, the posse often did cross over that line. There are many citizens and quite a few lawmakers who felt that the posse was little more than a band of outlaws, hired assassins who hid behind the dubious authority of deputies' badges. It was also pointed out by these detractors that very few of the wanted men they went after were ever brought back alive, including even some who were being pursued for the simple purpose of being served a subpoena to appear in civil court. The Boise Statesman and other newspapers had written editorials critical of the Idaho Auxiliary Police Officer's Posse, pointing out that, despite its name, it had nothing to do with peace. Some of those newspapers had paid for their critical observations by having their offices vandalized by irate citizens who supported the posse, or so it was claimed. At this moment, Sherman and a few members of the posse were engaged in one of the many private police force operations by which it managed to earn its keep. They were operating in the Sawtooth Mountains, and Colonel Sherman stepped up on a rock and looked down toward a little cabin that was nestled against the base of the sheer side of Snowy Peak. The posse had trailed Lewis Blackburn to this cabin, and now their quarry was trapped. The beauty of it was that Blackburn had no idea he was trapped. He thought he was quite secure in the cabin. Part of the reason for Lewis Blackburn's complacency was due to the fact that he didn't even know he was being trailed. 2 weeks earlier, Lewis Blackburn had been tried for the murder of James Dixon. At least three witnesses testified that Dixon not only started the fight, but he had also drawn first. The jury believed the witnesses and found Blackburn not guilty and not guilty by reason of self-defense. The judge released him from custody, and Blackburn went on his way a free man. The problem with the court finding was that not everyone agreed with the verdict, and principal among those who disagreed was Augustus Dixon, James Dixon's father. And because the senior Dixon had made a fortune in gold and was now one of the wealthiest and most powerful men in Idaho, he was able to use both his money and influence to find an alternate path to justice, or at least the justice he sought. Dixon managed to convince a cooperative judge to hold a civil trial. It was Augustus Dixon's intention to sue Lewis Blackburn for depriving him of his son. No official law agency of the Territory of Idaho would serve a subpoena for the civil trial, but then Dixon didn't want any official law officer involved in the process. Dixon hired Clay Sherman and his Idaho Auxiliary Peace Officers Posse to run Blackburn down and bring him back for civil trial. Sherman had 8 men with him, and as he looked back at them, he saw that everyone had found a place with a good view and a clear line of fire toward the cabin. Sherman turned to Pope Terrell, his second in command.
Lieutenant?
Yes, Colonel?
It is my belief, based upon our conversation with Mr. Dixon, that he doesn't particularly want us to bring Blackburn back alive.
Yes, sir. That is my belief as well.
You know what that means, then, don't you?
Yes, sir. We gotta get him to take a shot at us first.
You know what to do.
Polk nodded, then cupped his hand around his mouth.
Blackburn! Lewis Blackburn, come out!
What? Who's calling?
That cabin with your hands up.
What do you mean, come out with my hands up? Why should I do that? What do you want?
I have a summons to take you back for the murder of James Dixon.
You're crazy! I already been tried and found innocent.
You're being tried again.
Well, my lawyer said I can't be tried again.
Your lawyer lied. And if you don't come out of your cabin now, I'm going to open fire.
Go away. You ain't got no right to take me back.
You're going back whether it's dead or alive.
As Sherman and Polk expected, a pistol shot rang out from inside the cabin. The pistol shot wasn't aimed and was fired more as a warning than any act of hostile intent.
All right, boys, he shot at us. He shot at us, and now if we kill him, it's self-defense. Open fire!
For the next several minutes, the sound of gunfire echoed back from the sheer wall of Snowy Peak as Sherman, Polk, and the other men with them fired shot after shot into the cabin.
Cease fire! Lieutenant Terrell, you and Scraggs go down there and have a look.
With a nod of acceptance, Polk and Scraggs left the relative safety of the rocks, then climbed down the hill to approach the cabin. Not one shot was fired from the cabin. Finally, the two men disappeared around behind the cabin, and, a moment later, the front door of the cabin opened, and Polk stepped outside, then waved his hand.
He's dead.
Gentlemen, we've done a good day's work here today.
Boise City. For a time during the gold rush, the city of Boise had prospered and boomed. After the gold rush, Boise began declining in population and had shrunk to less than 1,000 people in 1870. But now, with both the territorial prison and the territorial capital there, some wag suggested that there was very little difference in character between the prisoners and politicians, there had been a rather substantial rebirth, and once again, Boise was a booming community. Clay Sherman kept an office in Boise, boldly placing it right next door to the territorial capitol building. He harbored no reservations about advertising his location. A sign hung from the front of the office proclaiming, "Idaho Auxiliary Peace Officers Posse, Colonel Clay Sherman commanding, Private Police Service." At the moment, Sherman sat behind his office desk meeting with Polk Terrell, his second in command. Polk had brought him a proposal for a job down on the Snake River in Owyhee County.
What do you think, Colonel? Should we take the job?
I don't know. It's not the kind of thing we normally do.
No, but he's offering $1,500, and the job don't seem all that hard to do. I don't think we should just walk away from it.
Who is it that's wanting to hire us?
His name is Marcus Kincaid. He's a rancher down in Owyhee County.
Sherman, who had once been an Arizona Ranger, stroked his jaw for a moment as he contemplated the suggestion his second-in-command had made.
If you ask me, I think we should do it. I mean, we don't need everyone. I could probably take care of it myself.
All right, I tell you what. How about you go down there and meet with this fella? If it looks like something you can handle, go ahead and do it.
By myself?
Why not? You just said you could probably handle it by yourself.
Well, yeah, I think I can, but maybe I should take a few of the men with me?
No, because of the type of operation it is, I want to keep as much separation as I can between that job and the posse. In fact, I think you should quit the organization.
What? No, now wait, I didn't have nothing like that in mind. I was just suggesting that it might be a good way to make some money.
Sherman held up his hand to halt the protest.
Don't worry, you won't really be quitting. We'll just make everyone think you have. We can let it out that I fired you.
Oh, all right. Whatever you say. As long as you ain't kicking me out, I mean.
Now, why would I want to kick you out, Polk? You're one of the best I ever ridden with. I told you leaving us would be just for show, just to keep anyone from tracing your operation back to us.
What if I need help?
If after you get down there you decide that you need help, hire some locals. If the job is really worthwhile, you should be able to afford it.
Oh, the job will be worthwhile, all right. I don't see how it can miss.
King Hill, Idaho Territory. Joel Matthews, president of the Cattlemen's Bank and Loan of King Hill, sat behind his desk reading a newspaper. To some, Matthews' office might have been considered messy, but because it was the office of a bank president, it was just considered busy. The desk was filled with stacks of paper, though he did manage to keep enough room left on his desk for an ink blotter and an inkwell and pen. The walls of his office were festooned with pictures, including one of a 442 engine with steam gushing from its piston rods as it thundered beneath a plume of smoke, pulling a string of passenger cars across a high trestle that afforded a grandiose mountain vista. There was also a portrait of the bank president, Joel Matthews, as well as a calendar with a picture of a brightly colored array of pumpkins, corn, apples, peppers, and pears.
Mr. Matthews?
Matthews looked up from the paper to see someone standing at his desk. The man was medium height, slender, and well-groomed. His hair was very light, almost blonde, and his eyes were such a pale blue that one could almost say they had no color at all. Matthews recognized him at once.
Ah, Marcus Kincaid. It's so good to see you.
I came to talk about that proposal we discussed.
Good, good. I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have about it.
Matthews put the paper down.
Anything interesting in the paper?
A very nice story about Kitty Wellington's ranch. But I'm certain, given the circumstances, that you read the story.
I read it.
But did you also read the article about the shootout over in Green River City, Wyoming?
The story makes this Matt Jensen fellow into quite the hero, doesn't it?
Yes. From time to time, editorial writers wax on about the spirit of the West. Most of it, I'm sure, is just hyperbole, but I've read about Matt Jensen before, and occasionally someone like Jensen comes along and you think maybe there's something to it. Clearly, Matt Jensen is a living manifestation of the spirit of the West.
Come on, Mr. Matthews, don't you think it's possible that the person who wrote this story may be engaging in a bit of this same hyperbole?
I suppose that could be true. Still, it's reassuring to believe that there are such men out there, men who are dedicated to fighting evil and doing what is right and true.
I suppose so.
Well, Mr. Kincaid...
The bank president leaned back in his chair and hooked his thumbs into the shoulder openings of his vest.
You are here, so am I to take it that you've decided?
Yes, I have.
Ah, that's good to hear. Tell me, what have you decided? Do you want to buy the loan?
Yes.
You are sure now that you want to do this? I don't want to be in the position of having you pushed into something that, upon further reflection, you regret.
I'm positive I want to do it. And don't worry, there will be no regrets.
I don't have to tell you that we're talking about a lot of money here. The original loan was for $25,000. With interest, the amount due now is considerably more.
I just want you to tell me again what happens if the borrower cannot make payment.
Oh, you don't have to worry about it. Mrs. Wellington has pledged Coventry on the Snake as collateral. That means there are more than significant assets against the note to cover the loan. If payment cannot be made, those assets will be forfeited to the mortgage holder.
Which will be me if I purchase the loan right now, is that right?
Yes, that will be you.
So if I make this investment, I will be protected.
No, indeed you will.
Do you think it's a good investment?
I think it is an excellent investment. Why, back east, banks sell off loans all the time. It's perfectly safe. As I told you, if the loan goes into default, the assets will come to you. And of course, if the loan is paid on time, which I have every reason to believe that it will be, you will recoup every cent of your money. Plus the interest that will have accrued between the time of your acquisition and the time of the settlement of the loan.
If you're sure the loan is going to be repaid, why are you willing to sell it?
We are a bank, Mr. Kincaid, and in order to function as a bank is supposed to function, it is necessary that we maintain a significant balance of funds. From time to time, we get, well, to be honest, a little overextended. When that happens, we can't make any new loans. Selling this note will give us more flexibility in handling customers who require new loans.
All right. How long will this transaction take?
Not very long at all. In fact, we can do it this very day. As soon as you make the payment, we can draw up the papers transferring the mortgage to you.
Exactly how much money will it take at this moment to purchase the loan?
The initial loan was for $25,000, but currently, with accrued interest, the amount due is $28,517.36.
And you say that she has pledged the entire ranch against the loan?
Yes. Mrs. Wellington, being a woman and all, our board of directors insisted upon more collateral than they would have had the borrower been a man. As I'm sure you're aware, the assets are easily worth 20 times the face value of the note.
Thank you. I will draw a draft for immediate payment. Oh, and Mr. Matthews, if you would, please say nothing of this to anyone else.
Oh, you needn't worry about that. Confidentiality is the policy of the Cattlemen's Bank and Loan.
I appreciate that.
Kincaid began filling out the draft.
As a matter of fact, if you wish, for a nominal fee, we will continue to process the loan for you. That way, as far as Mrs. Wellington is concerned, the bank is still the mortgage holder. For your purposes, that might be better.
How would it be better?
Well, say, for example, Mrs. Wellington finds out you hold the note instead of the bank, and suppose she's unable to make the payment on time. It's much easier for the bank to turn down any request for extensions on the loan than it would be for you.
Yes, I can see what you're talking about. Good, let's do it that way then.
Finishing the draft, Kincaid held up the document. He then passed it across the desk to Matthews.
I guess that makes me a member of the banking business.
I guess it does at that. I only wish that other businessmen were as astute as you are.
When Polk Terrell rode into King Hill, a train sat at the depot. The engine, painted green and trimmed in red, glistened in the golden light of the setting sun. The engineer leaned through the window of the cab and held a long-stemmed pipe clenched tightly between his teeth. He watched from his lordly position as arriving passengers left the train and departing passengers boarded. The restaurant Polk was looking for stood next door to the depot, an adobe building that had recently been given a fresh coat of whitewash. A sign hung in front of the restaurant that identified it as Delmonico's. A hitching rail ran all the way across the front of the building.
Yeah.
Polk dismounted, tied his horse to the rail, then climbed the two wooden steps to the porch. Pope was a relatively short man, but he was powerfully built, with a barrel chest and muscular arms. His head was bald and round, and because one could almost imagine that Polk had no neck, it looked rather like a cannonball resting on his shoulders. He was greeted by an employee of the restaurant as soon as he stepped inside.
May I help you, sir?
Now, I'm supposed to meet someone here, only I never met him before, so I'm not...
Would you be Mr. Terrell?
Yeah.
Your party's back here.
When the waiter took Polk back to the table in the corner of the restaurant, Marcus Kincaid stood to greet him. There could not have been a more dramatic contrast in the appearance of the two men. Terrell wore denim trousers and a white stained shirt. Kincaid stood attired in a brown tweed suit. Polk looked of the rough-hewn log on the fireplace hearth. Kincaid, the cut flower in a vase. The two men sat down.
Thank you for agreeing to meet me.
You have the money?
Yes, half, now, as we agreed.
Kincaid took an envelope from inside his jacket pocket and handed it to Polk. Polk took the money from the envelope.
Don't count it here.
Polk looked up with a frown on his face as he continued to count the money.
$740, $750. All right, it's all here.
He put the money back into the envelope, then put the envelope into his pocket.
What do you want me to do?
Have you heard of a ranch called Coventry on the Snake? It's near Medbury.
Yeah, I've heard of it. Owned by a foreigner.
It was owned by an Englishman named Thomas Wellington. Now it's owned by an American woman. When Wellington died, it became the property of his widow. She has invested heavily into the operation and is badly in debt. She needs desperately to sell some horses, and she has to do it soon or she will lose the ranch.
You want me to help her sell the horses? I don't know what you thought I could do for her. I'm not a salesman.
No, it's just the opposite. I don't want you to help her save the ranch. I want you to make sure she loses the ranch.
I'm glad to hear that. I think that might be easier to do. You have an idea as to how I need to do it?
No, use your own initiative. I don't care how you do it, as long as you do it.
You don't care how I do it?
Well, I don't want you to burn any of the buildings or anything like that. I don't want the ranch destroyed. All I want is for it to fail.
That's all you want, huh?
That's all I want. Do you think you can handle that without too much difficulty?
Yeah, as long as you stay out of my way and let me handle things.
Trust me on this, Mr. Terrell. You shall have free rein. In fact, I would be very pleased if we never saw each other again.
Except for the final payment.
Yes, except for the final payment.
When Polk Terrell stepped inside the Sand Spur Saloon in Medbury for the first time, he looked around the room until he saw the table that he wanted. It was slightly more than halfway back in the room and sitting close, but not uncomfortably close to the stove. It was also situated so as to give him a good view, both of the front door and the side door, and this was important to him. A person in Polk's business, and with his reputation, made enough enemies that it was always a good idea to know who was coming and going. The cowboy sat at the table with one of the bar girls. Polk walked up to the table and stood there staring at the cowboy. The cowboy glanced up at him.
Can I help you, mister?
You're sitting at my table.
What are you talking about, your table? I ain't never even seen you before.
I just arrived. I want this table.
What if I don't want to move?
Prue, honey, come on. Let's just go to another table.
I'm not going to let some son of a bitch just come in and order me away from this table.
Prue, please. If you want me to talk to you, you'll change tables.
Prue stared at Polk for a moment longer. Then he got up.
All right. I'm moving. But it ain't none of your doing. I'm moving because of Jenny.
Polk didn't answer, but as soon as Prue left, Polk sat down, then took out a deck of cards and dealt himself a game of solitaire. One of the other girls stepped up to the table.
Mister, you want anything to drink?
Beer.
Polk stayed at the saloon until it closed that night, drinking beer and playing solitaire. Except for his initial confrontation with a cowboy and occasionally ordering a beer, Polk spoke to no one and no one spoke to him. When he left, everyone breathed a sigh of relief and offered up a quick prayer that the strange, brooding, and frightening man would not return. To the chagrin of everyone, Polk returned the next day. This time, the man who was sitting at his table got up and moved without being asked. By the third day, Polk had clearly established a proprietary right to the table, and nobody sat at it, even when Polk wasn't present. On the third day, Marshal Sparks came to see him.
I've done some checking up on you, Terrell. That's who you are, isn't it? Polk Terrell?
That's me.
Polk continued to play solitaire all the time the marshal spoke to him.
What I want to know is, what is a member of the Idaho Auxiliary Peace Officers Posse doing in Medbury?
I ain't a member no more.
Yes, that's what I found out. At least you're honest about it.
Marshal, I haven't violated any of your laws since I arrived. And I'm not wanted. What do you want?
Nothing. I'm just curious as to why you're here, that's all.
I think you have a nice little town here. I just thought I'd visit here for a while. Like I said, I've not broken none of your laws, and I'm not wanted.
I hope things stay like that.
For the first few days, Polk Terrell was the talk of the town.
You know why he ain't a member no more? Because he was too violent, that's why.
Lord of mercy. Can you imagine someone who's too violent for the peace officer's posse? The posse makes Quantrill's bushwhackers seem like Sunday school boys.
By the end of 2 weeks, though, Polk was no longer the center of conversation or even attention. Because he sat at his table playing solitaire, he became as ubiquitous as the heating stove. He wasn't always alone, though. Gradually, Polk began to make a few friends, or at least acquaintances. Sam Logan was the first to come sit at the table with him. Al Madison and Ken Jernigan came as well, and sometimes all three would come. The telegraph office was located in one end of the railroad depot, so located because Union Pacific Railroad provided the Western Union office in Medbury with at least 90% of its business. Polk stepped up to the telegraph window. A sign on the telegrapher's desk identified him as William S. Tate, and though Polk had no way of knowing, Tate was recording all the latest changes in train departures and arrivals. This was absolutely necessary in order to schedule the use of the track to avoid wrecks. Polk waited until Tate sent a message. Finally, Tate turned to him.
I need to send a message.
Tate gave the man a tablet and pencil, and Polk wrote the message, then handed it back. The message read, "Found. Three men to work for me. Will pay from profits."
Where does this message go?
To Colonel Clay Sherman, Idaho Auxiliary Peace Officers Posse in Boise.
That'll be $1.20.
Damn, that's kind of high, ain't it? Only costs 3 cents to send it by mail.
A letter will get to Boise in days. This will get there in 30 seconds.
Damn, highway robbery is what it is.
Polk paid for the telegram, then went back to his table at the Sand Spur. That night, when Polk's three new friends joined him at the table, speaking animatedly but too quietly for anyone to hear what they were saying, Prue stood at the end of the bar nursing a beer, looking toward the table and chatting with one of the young women who worked the bar.
Logan, Madison, and Jernigan. Those are three of the biggest pole cats in the county. They can't any one of them hold a job anywhere. Stands to reason they become friends with someone like Polk Terrell.
Oh, you're just mad because Terrell ran you away from the table the first night he was here.
He didn't run me away, you did. I would have fought him for it.
I know, but I didn't want to see you get your face bruised.
She put her hand up to his face and rubbed her fingers lightly across his cheek.
It's such a handsome face.
By any means of measurement, Kitty Wellington was a beautiful woman. Tall, statuesque. She had blonde hair and blue eyes, naturally long lashes, high cheekbones, and full lips. She was a widow, still young, because when she married, she had been 30 years younger than her husband. After her husband died, Kitty inherited the ranch, a parcel of land that was bordered on the north by the Snake River and Castle Creek, and on the west and south by a network of interconnecting creeks, the Blue, the Bottle, and the Mill. It was this ready availability of water, as well as a plentiful supply of good grass, that made Coventry on the Snake so valuable. It was not by mere coincidence that the name of the ranch, Coventry on the Snake, had an old-world flavor. Kitty's husband, Sir Thomas Denby Wellington, the 7th Earl of Buckinghamshire, had named it after his ancestral home, Coventry on the Wye, in Buckinghamshire, England. But Kitty was not just a beautiful woman who happened to inherit a lot of land. She had turned Coventry on the Snake into one of the finest horse ranches in the country, and she had done it all since the death of her husband. This morning, Kitty sat in her study, working on the books. The door to her study being open, Kitty turned in her chair. She saw Tyrone Canfield, her ranch foreman, standing there, holding his hat in his hand.
Yes, Tyrone, did you want to see me?
Tyrone rolled his hat in his hand, obviously not wanting to say what he had to say.
What is it, Tyrone? What's wrong?
I hate to tell you this, Mrs. Wellington, but we're missing 75 head of Arabians.
What? Are you sure?
Yes, ma'am. I'm positive. We've been keeping a real good count of the Arabians, especially since they're the ones you're selling to the army. Last count, we had 885. This morning, we only had 810. And we counted them twice, just to make sure.
Well, this is a big ranch with a lot of rangeland. Maybe they just got out of the field where we were holding them.
No, ma'am. We've looked all over the range. The horses are gone.
Stolen?
Yes, ma'am. There's no doubt in my mind but that they were stolen.
75 horses? Oh, Tyrone. That's $7,500.
Yes, ma'am. I know it is. Mrs. Wellington, if you don't mind, I think I'm going to put out night riders to keep watch from now on.
No, I don't mind at all. I think that's a very good idea.
Without a moon in the midnight sky, the stars seemed bright enough to cast shadows. Three young men rode around the milling shapes and shadows that made up the herd. It had been a week now since the 75 horses disappeared. Since that time, Tyrone had put out riders every night to keep watch over the horses. Though it would have been more efficient for them to separate, the boring aspects of the task caused the three Nighthawks to ride together so they could visit. Prue was one of the riders, and he and another rider teased the youngest one.
What do you mean? Are you trying to tell me you never been with a woman?
The youngest cowboy, Hank, felt his face flush with embarrassment.
I ain't never thought I was old enough, is all. And coming from the orphanage like I done, I ain't never really had the opportunity to be with no woman.
Yeah, you don't need no opportunity. All you gotta do is go into town and visit Flatnose Sue.
Timmy, the third member of the group, rolled his eyes.
Yeah, that's right. And being as you ain't never been with a woman before, that makes you lucky.
How does that make me lucky?
Well, tell him, Prue. How does it make him lucky?
You're the one that brought it up, Timmy. You tell him.
All right, Dan. Here's why it makes you lucky. If you go into Flatnose Sue's place and tell her you're a virgin, why, she's such a big-hearted woman that on your first time, she'll let you do it for free.
I ain't no virgin.
What you mean you ain't no virgin? You just said you ain't never been with a woman before.
I ain't never been with no woman before, but that don't make me a virgin.
Well, now, sure it does. If you ain't been with a woman before, then you're a virgin.
Virgins is women, ain't they?
It ain't only women that's virgins. A woman that ain't never had a man is a virgin, yeah, but a man that ain't never had a woman, he's a virgin too.
Are you sure about that? I ain't never heard of no man virgin.
And you know all about such things, do you? I mean, being as you're so experienced and all.
No, I don't, really. Well, I just thought, that is, I didn't know that men could be virgins, too. All right, if that's the case, then I guess I am a virgin.
So, like I said, all you gotta do is go into Flatnose Sue's place and tell her you're a virgin.
Then what?
Then you don't have to do nothing. Flatnose Sue will take care of that little situation for you. Right, Prue?
That's right.
For sure?
Oh, for sure. Well, Flatnose Sue, she's the oldest one there, and she runs the place. So she'll break you in her own self.
Break me in her own self? Wait, what do you mean? Are you saying I'd have to, do it? With Flatnose Sue? Didn't you say she's the oldest one there?
Well, that she is. How old do you reckon she is? Prue 50, 60 years old?
Yeah, maybe 60. I don't think she's any older than 60. Maybe 65. And if she's any older than that, then it ain't by all that much.
But I'm only 16. I don't want to do it with somebody's grandma. Couldn't I do it with one of the younger ones?
You don't want a young one for your first time. You want someone who knows what to do so they can break in proper. Besides, why are you asking that? You wouldn't turn her down, would you? That would hurt her feelings.
Now, you sure don't want to hurt Flatnose Sue's feelings. Because if you do that, why, you'll piss off all the women that's in the whorehouse. And they won't none of them have anything to do with any of us anymore. Is that what you want to do?
No, I guess not. If she says I gotta do it with her, why, I reckon I will. Hey, why do they call her Flatnose Sue?
That's right. You ain't never seen her, have you?
No. I told you, I ain't never been to no whorehouse before.
Well, sir, they call her Flatnose Sue because she's done got her nose broke so many times by drunk cowboys and the like. And when you look at her sideways, it perk now looks like she don't have no nose at all.
Oh.
No, now she don't look all that bad when you're looking at her from the front. Except for how old she is.
Tell you what, why don't we all go into town first thing in the morning after we get off of work? Seeing as how we're going to be riding herd all night, it'll be early in the morning and there won't hardly be nobody else there. We can have our pick.
Except for Hank. He don't get his pick because he'll have to lay with Flatnose Sue.
Yeah, but it'll be free.
You lucky dog.
Timmy reached over and struck Hank playfully on the shoulder.
You're going to get it for free.
Yeah, I'm just real lucky. Sounds like one of the colts might have got somewhere it shouldn't be. I'll go take a look.
Prue waited until Hank rode out into the darkness.
We got that boy so uptight that right now, you couldn't drive a straw up his ass with a 10-pound hammer.
You sure Flatnose Sue will go along with it?
She said she would. It's gonna be funnier than all hell.
Yeah, I reckon so, but sort of a dirty trick when you think about it. Lord, I hate to think of breaking him in with Flatnose Sue. I mean, she could turn a fella off women for life.
Ah, she ain't really all that bad.
Well, how do you know? Well, I'll be damned. You've had her, ain't you? I can't believe you actually had her. Does Jenny know that?
What's Jenny got to do with it?
I thought you was kind of sweet on her. You're always hanging out with her at the Sand Spur.
She's supposed to hang out with me. That's her job.
It's the job of all the girls in the Sand Spur. But she's near about the only one I ever see you with.
Maybe you got it backward. Maybe she's sweet on me.
I can see that.
What the hell is Hank shooting at?
I don't know.
Hank! Hank! What are you shooting at? A cougar?
Hank! Where are you at? How come he ain't answering us?
We better go see what's going on.
Timmy and Prue were both wearing guns, and though sometimes in town they liked to wear them low and kicked out in the way of a gunfighter, neither of them had ever done anything but take a few shots at a rabbit now and then. Nevertheless, both men drew their pistols, then rode out into the darkness to check on Hank. Before they had gone too far, the flash of gunshots lit up the herd of horses.
Rustlers!
Sitting quietly in his saddle after having dispatched a few other riders to take care of business, Polk Terrell saw one of those riders, Sam Logan, appear from the darkness.
What was the shooting?
It was just like you said. She's got night riders out watching over her herd.
How many of them was there?
Well, there was three, but we took care of all of them.
Good. Now round up 75 horses and let's get out of here.
Say, Polk, I heard that these here horses is worth $100 apiece. How come we only be getting $25 apiece for them?
Because to us, $25 apiece is all they're worth.
Why's that?
This here is the only horse ranch in the county. You want to take them in Medbury to sell, do you? Or maybe to Glen's Ferry or King Hill?
No, more than likely the horses would be recognized there.
And don't you think it would be better to sell them to someone who will give us $25 a horse and not ask questions?
Yeah, I guess you're right.
Maybe you aren't as dumb as I thought.
Out in the dark, Jason Pruitt crawled on his stomach until he reached Timmy and shook the body.
Timmy! Timmy!
Prue dare not speak any louder and risk being heard. Helplessly, he lay in the dark and watched the rustlers round up the horses, then take them away.
Son of a bitch. That's Polk Terrell.
Prue reached for his pistol, but his holster was empty. He had lost his gun somewhere in the dark. Not until they were gone did he get up. Favoring the wound in his shoulder, he found his horse and rode back to the big house to report the robbery. He Mrs. Wellington wasn't going to like this. She wasn't going to like it at all. The only reason there were Nighthawks at all was to prevent just such a thing from happening. At least, that's what they were supposed to do. But Prue and his friends had failed.
I arranged for Timmy's body to be sent back to Missouri where his family is. He'll be going out on tomorrow's train.
Tyrone Canfield had been foreman of Coventry on the Snake for 18 years, long before Kitty married Sir Thomas Wellington. Thomas died 3 years earlier, but at Kitty's request, Tyrone stayed on as her ranch foreman.
What about Hank?
Well, Hank, being raised in an orphanage and all, I'd done like you said. I made arrangements to bury him in the cemetery in town.
Not in Potter's Corner?
Oh, no, ma'am. He'll have him a spot right in the middle of the cemetery.
Good.
You're a fine woman, Miss Wellington. You've always had a soft spot in your heart for orphans.
Yes, I have.
How is Prue? The doctor was just coming out when I left to go into town.
The wound was in his shoulder and the doctor got the bullet out. He said Prue will be all right if the wound doesn't fester.
We lost another 75 horses. Prue saw them this time, and he said he was sure that the leader of the bunch was Poke Terrell. I told that to the sheriff, but he won't do anything about it.
Who's Poke Terrell? I don't believe I've ever heard of him.
No, he's not the kind of person you would like to meet. He's a scoundrel who hangs out in a sand spur saloon. They say he used to belong to the Idaho Auxiliary Peace Officers posse. If so, that doesn't speak very well for him or the posse.
Does Marshal Sparks know that Terrell's the one who's been stealing my horses?
I told him that Prue said he saw him.
Is the Marshal going to arrest Terrell?
No, ma'am. For one thing, he says that identification made in the dark won't hold up. To tell the truth, Mrs. Wellington, I think the Marshal would like to do something about it, but it's just too overwhelming for him.
If you ask me, the whole thing is just too overwhelming, not just for Marshal Sparks, but for all concerned.
Marcus Kincaid strode into the room.
I've told Kitty that the best thing she can do is to sell all the horses off now. In fact, I think she should sell the land, too.
Hello, Mr. Kincaid.
Tyrone?
Sell the land to who, Marcus? To you?
If you'd like to sell it to me, I'd be happy to buy it. After all, it was my land long before it was ever yours.
It was never your land. It was Tommy's land, to do with as he saw fit, and he saw fit to leave it to me.
He left the land to you after only 1 year of marriage. He was your husband for 1 year. He was my stepfather for 12 years.
He was never your stepfather.
He was in all but name.
I'll admit that after he married your mother, he treated you as his own son, but he never adopted you. Anyway, why are you complaining? It isn't as if he abandoned you. Even before he died, he divided all of his holdings in two and gave you half.
Yes, including all his money in England, which he gave half to me and half to you. That would have been over $500,000 for each of us, but as you well know, the family back in England has prevented either one of us from collecting our rightful inheritance.
Then, as I've said before, your anger should be with those in England, not with me.
Kitty, I don't want to fight. We're on the same side here. I just heard that you had another episode of rustling, and I came out to see how you're doing. And to be honest, I'm also suggesting that you may have taken a bigger bite than you can swallow.
So, you're willing to come to my rescue, right, Marcus?
In a manner of speaking. Just think about it, Kitty. If you sold everything to me, just the land, mind you, I'm not interested in the house. You can keep the house. Why, you would have enough money to live comfortably for the rest of your life. That would show the Wellingtons back in England that neither one of us needs them.
And you would do what? Get rid of the horses and raise cattle?
You have to admit that raising cattle is a lot more practical.
I appreciate the offer, Marcus. I really do. But raising horses was a dream that Tommy and I had together. If I don't follow through with it, I'd feel as if I'd let him down.
I've only got one more thing to say. I happen to know that you have a considerable loan against this place. I am sure that you know if you can't pay off the loan, you're going to be faced with losing everything. And I'll tell you the truth, Kitty. I don't see any way on earth you're going to be able to pay that loan.
I have no intention of defaulting on the loan. I will pay it.
How?
I'll pay it.
By July 4th?
That is when your loan is due, isn't it? July 4th?
Yes.
That's just over a month from now.
What if I am a few days late with my payment? It isn't going to make that much difference.
What makes you think that?
Think about it, Marcus. The bank wants the money I owe them. They don't want the ranch. Anyway, there's no problem. I have a contract to sell some horses in Chicago. Once I deliver those horses, I'll have more than enough money to pay off the loan. And I'll have the property and the horses free and clear.
You have a contract to sell horses in Chicago?
Yes.
But even so, how many horses can you sell in Chicago?
My contract calls for 500.
500? That's a lot of horses. Who would buy 500 horses?
The U.S. Army. So you see, Marcus, there's no problem. I will get the bank paid off.
In time?
Yes, in time. That is, assuming I have no problems in getting the horses to Chicago.
Well, therein is the rub. Kitty, I don't want to be the naysayer here, but just what makes you think you're going to be able to get your horses to Chicago? You haven't even been able to protect them when they're on your own property.
Kitty walked over to a table and picked up a copy of the Boise Statesman.
Did you read this article?
Kitty showed the paper to Kincaid, pointing to the article in question.
About the shootout over in Wyoming? Yes, I read it. What about it?
Read the last sentence. The one that says, Matt Jensen is a friend of what is right, and a foe of those who would visit their evil deeds upon innocent people. What's so funny?
Do you really think Matt Jensen, this hero, will come to your rescue wearing shining armor and riding on a white horse?
Well, not the shining armor, and maybe not even the white horse, but yes, I do think he'll come to help me.
What makes you think that?
Because he's Matt Jensen.